Morty, folks. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. I'm delighted to see you. I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group of AA in Southern Pines, North Carolina, and I am delighted to be here. And well, I won't even go into it. I'll tell you one thing: it'll test your spiritual program to be doing an AA meeting in Whiskey Pete's. By golly, I look like Whiskey Pete kicked in on me this morning. And I see my reputation got ahead of me a little bit, that I'm a bad drinker. This is Tom Smallwood's book. Nobody here could lift it but Calvin. And heavy-duty thing. Other than just thanking you for a great conference, it's been just a super, super deal. And I'll give you a little bit of a clue about how I want to take off with this is today. Number one, I really do want to thank you guys for this. I think it genuinely is, like my buddy said, it genuinely is a unique conference. I've been to a ton of them, but this is the only one I've seen that was built entirely around the steps. And another thing that was unique about it, the youngest speaker was 30 years sober. Man, this was a geriatric display. And what assembled was some of the best who did some of their very best. That was just outstanding work. And I was just honored to be in the middle of that. I came down, the reason I'm huffing, not huffing in the usual sense, but it's just reason I'm panting a little. I got all the way to the door and realized I didn't have my notes. What I had was my bill from the Rio in Las Vegas. What happens at the Rio in Las Vegas stays at the Rio in Las Vegas. I had to go back and climb 10 floors of stairs. That's a lie. Wore me out riding the elevator. I want to express appreciation to folk that were. I know Bob and I were riding by this place one day, and he was on. I couldn't imagine him being on a cell phone. We're thinking about starting a special project to give him a cell phone implant, so he wanted to pick it up. But he was on the phone with this facility talking about this conference, and now we're here in fruition. So I appreciate that great work from not only Bob and the Las Vegas crowd, but Palmdale, L.A., a bunch of folks around that germinated this idea. And then supported it big time. So it's just great to see this and great to be here for the fruition. I tell you what I want to do. One of the few advantages of being old is you get to meet some of the old historic figures in AA. One of them was Sam Shoemaker. And Sam Shoemaker was a wonderful friend. He was a minister of some stripe and a great friend of AA. And he described our fellowship as shirt sleeves Christianity or shirt sleeves spirituality, and it was a good apt description that he observed. And today, I think I've got about two jobs here. This has been a high energy, high level, very very skillful, beautifully presented program, and you couldn't help getting pumped up pretty high with this caliber of stuff. And my job is to get it dumbed down a little. I got some of y'all will be on I-5 before long. And I got to get you prepared to go back out there in that world and be ready to practice road rage and all that kind of stuff. If you leave here too blissfully supreme and you may get knocked out, you know. So anyway, I want to get you prepared. And I want to approach this in a way that Sam Shoemaker called it shirt sleeve spirituality. I think these last three steps, I want to approach it as sort of the spiritual life in combat boots. I want to not get into the poetic very much and not get into a lot of ritual worship or anything like that. I want to sort of take a look at those steps, not only because I like to do it that way, but because I think it's somewhat the message of those last three steps. And I'll tell you what I mean. But I'll tell you one other thing so we can just kind of relax and enjoy it. I'm going to quit. I probably won't be finished, but I'm going to quit at 11 o'clock or, well, I don't have to say or now. It'd be 11 o'clock. I was going to say or 2 hours, whichever comes first, but 11 is going to come first. So I'll either quit when I finish or no later than 11 o'clock. And so we can just kind of relax and enjoy it. So what I want to do is just kind of visit with these three steps in the style of action, in the style of putting this program to work as a way of life. In 10, 11, 12, I think we start talking about a word that we rarely talk about around here. It's a word called leadership. And leadership is not a dirty word. It's not an inappropriate word. It's an extremely important, valid word to describe some of the responsibilities that we have in AA if we're going to be responsible members. And so leadership is a very important aspect of AA service. You see it in a lot of faces. Sponsorship is leadership. Taking on the responsibilities to put this idea into fruition and make it come into a great conference, that's leadership. And without it, nothing happens. So I want to visit in that area and talk about leadership as it comes out of those steps. And so let me get going. To kind of lead into that, just think a minute about the promises. I won't read them. But those promises are kind of an interesting piece of our book. They describe what sounds like almost an idyllic existence, you know, that if we do these actions, some things will happen that are beyond belief to a first-time observer. And what it says at the end of those is that these things happen, that we will be amazed, right at the beginning of it says, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. And we don't have to finish the amends process to start realizing the promises in our lives. We'll be amazed before we're halfway through. And it lists a whole range of things that defy imagination. And those things are really true. And then right after the, I'm not going to read a whole lot to you because I've memorized the whole book. I do lie a little. But I just read this little, there's not a whole lot of reading to do with step 10, but I won't read the whole deal. I'll just read the introduction into 10 and a little bit of what catches the flavor that I want to get at. So we're through with those promises and it says these things are going to happen. They're being fulfilled all the time. And they'll materialize if we work for them. And then it says, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take a personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Now listen close to this part. We've entered the world of the Spirit. Yeah, what we've just gotten through with is fundamental surrender and hope in the first three steps. We've looked at understanding what alcoholism is about, how desperate the condition is. We've opened up to another human. We've made that tremendous decision in 6 and 7 for new life. In 8 and 9, we've gone back and started to repair some of the damage. And so now we move into a different dimension. It says we continue to take personal inventory. We vigorously set right the mistakes. We commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. But now we have entered the world of the Spirit. And this next sentence is a real good one for me. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. It's not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. And we'll go back to that in just a minute. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. Then listen to the action. We discuss them with someone and immediately make amends quickly if we've harmed someone. We don't go into Freudian analysis or deep think tank stuff. We don't labor over it. You know, we get restored to life. We don't transcend life. We get restored to life. And it has its bumps and things. And so when we get into some screwball thing, we take care of it quickly before it turns into the resentment that Sandy was talking about so well the other night, Friday night. So we deal with that very quickly. And then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others, our code. And I think that's the tone of these steps, that certainly we goof, but we don't spend the rest of our lives staring at our navel in inventory. You know, what we do is get on with the business of living. And as we live, we've got corrective measures available to us, but we don't waste a lot of time on that. What we do is immediately turn ourselves, our attention to how we can be of help to others. And so that's the theme of a lot of step 10 to me. That gears us up for action. Let me talk just a little, well, you don't have much choice. I mean, you could leave, but you know I'm going to talk about it anyway. Let me talk a little bit about that thing about growing and understanding effectiveness. That can be like a throwaway kind of cliche sounding thing. But I think there's a heavy message in that. You know, that now that I've gotten through dealing with this sort of self-centered condition, I now shift my focus to a strange expression of selfishness. This is the weirdest selfishness in the world. It's about 10% gimme and about 90% give. And if we don't learn that elusive secret, we miss the whole deal, because we learn that it's in helping others that we strengthen and we gain our greatest rewards. And so now we look to understanding and effectiveness. Now, what does that mean? I want to give you some examples of what I wrote earlier this morning in understanding and effectiveness and looking at the terrain that we're in. I want to visit a few of these things. And it's not to react in alarm or dismay or chagrin or any of that. It's just to develop understanding of the problems I observe. As I get through with the critical care of Tom I, it's time to start taking a responsible place as well. So I want to have some understanding. It's not enough to have alarm or concern. So I want to be able to understand things I see. I'll give you a couple examples. I was in some of you probably read it, a conference report came out maybe 3 or 4 years ago, something like that. I was in an area office at the time. And for the first time in my history in AA, which goes back almost 49 years, for the first time in that history, every number that we track in this fellowship was down. Every number that we track. And I'm talking about numbers of groups, numbers of members, literature sales, grapevine. Everything that we count was down. Well, that's kind of a startling thing to hear when you've never heard anything but up. Not all of a sudden, but now we observe that things are going down. Last year, I think, I was up in Chicago Sandy and I were doing a workshop in Chicago. And we had a panel, and the panel was made up of a Class A trust, non-alcoholic Class A trustee at large, and two delegates. And they were a very well-informed group. So I don't normally go to the mic much unless I'm invited. I've stayed up enough. And so I don't usually do it. But I just, it was too good an opportunity. So I just stood up and I said, I'd like to ask a question about sort of how are we doing? And I just cited what I just cited to you and said, how about telling me how we doing now? Are we better, worse, or same? The non-alcoholic trustee almost ran to the mic. He was anxious to talk about that. And what he shared, I wish I could tell you, was good news. But he's a well-informed man, extremely well-informed man. He said, I wish I could tell you this up, but every number is down further or the same. Well, in the real world, folks, you'd call that a recession. There'd be a lot of alarm about that. But it tends to be sort of unnoticed here. But those are in things of understanding. You got to have the information to have some understanding. And that's a big concern. And so what do you do about that? I don't think you have to start having revival meetings or anything like that. But having some understanding and knowing the problem generally creates some willingness to try to do something about it. Important thing to know. The numbers are down. First time in history. And they're not getting better, as far as I can tell, right now. I'm concerned about that. I hope you're concerned about that. I could go on for many other examples of what that reflects like in our relationship with the worlds around us. You could find a lot of other things to have some concern. But in understanding, and then in effectiveness, you know, what is it that we do? I did a panel at a conference I was involved in on effectiveness. It was the first panel in the memory of any person at the conference that they'd ever been into in AA that was about effectiveness. We don't tend to deal with that a lot. You know, we tend to be people who treat something, if we do it once, it becomes a sacred tradition. And we do it forever. It'll make a difference whether it works or not. We just keep on doing it. Almost routinize everything. And so that's the way we are. Give you an example of that. I was a while back, I was asked to come up and do an anniversary meeting at a place at Princeton University, a very enlightened, sophisticated place, home of Princeton University. And that's a real outstanding community. And the meeting I was to, the anniversary was a group that had been formed for the express purpose of dealing with people who had been mandated into Alcoholics Anonymous. And the motivation was they thought these folks just tended to get a sort of a shuffle around rather than a good, meaningful kind of welcome day. So they formed this group to provide a special environment to welcome them in. Good intent. So I'm chatting with the two founders of the group before the meeting. I said, well, tell me how it's going. And one of them said, oh, yeah, going great, man. We got people here all the time. We got folks here every week. Going good. And the other fellow said, wait a minute, what do you mean by that? I said, I mean, how's it going in terms of do you see people that you work with in this group moving on into recovery? And the two guys looked at each other with sort of blank stares and said, do you know anybody? And the other guy said, no, I don't either. Now, come on, guys, give me a break. 11 years in a far above average community. I don't care what you're selling. If you don't make a sale in 11 years, you better take a look. Something bad wrong. Good effort isn't enough. It's a presenting question about, is what I do an effective thing? And I think that's the message of this step. Now when I start thinking of others, rather than just reacting in dismay and discouragement, it's important for me to take a look at whether that can be done better. And by the way, that's the thing that troubled me enough, not just that one example, but it troubled me enough that in my little community, we decided to tackle that, and we have indeed eliminated mandated paper signing meetings in our community and replaced it with a better deal. So the concern about that can learn to understand and can lead to effectiveness. That's just one example of a thing of being alert to the quality of work that we're doing and the effectiveness, because we don't want to waste our time. God, nobody does. But it's very important to take a look at that thing. Who wrote these notes, but they're just awful. Okay, yeah. I finally found it. The revolving door. There's probably not a person in this room that doesn't have some active concern about the revolving door. And what I'm talking about is that we have huge numbers of people come to AA, and we have, it looks like, about an equal number leaving. Or maybe more, because their numbers are down. So I've been concerned for many years about this whole business of the revolving door. I think very few people come to AA prematurely. I think most people come here at the court of last resort. And just to demonize the guy who walks in as, well, he wasn't ready or he didn't want it or all that, that's not a good enough answer for me. I've got to take a look at the quality of what I'm doing. How well do I accommodate that person in AA and give them a solid introduction to what this program is about? That's what I have to do if I want to improve in understanding and effectiveness. I looked at that for a long time. I started doing a thing. Now, I'm not going to tell you any of my bad stuff, but I've got a lot of goofs I could really regale you with. But I'm going to talk about the W column instead of the other one. So what do you do about a thing like that? I started looking around for things that I thought might work. And I stumbled into a thing called Big Book Workshops. And some of us are aficionados of that activity. And so what I saw in that thing, it looked like there was an element of realism and real connection that went a step beyond just the average meeting. So I just decided to do one. I didn't know how. I'd never been to one. But what the heck? I mean, you got a book. I mean, what more you need? And so I said, shoot, I'm going to do it. And I got a buddy on the phone. We talked about it. Did one. And the first one I did was what we were doing was going through exhaustively through every line in the book. Wear you flat out. I'm telling you, last one I did the last long-term one I did, took 18 months. God knows, I thought I was going to get a watch or something when we got through with that. And that was a long time. I know we have incredible attention spans, but that's stretching it a little bit. So it was just too labor-intensive. It was just taking too much time. And if you got a lot of things you want to get done, you can't just tie down to one thing and make it a career. And so I just finished one last week, as a matter of fact, that we did in 14 weeks. And I really loved the format. I loved the 14 weeks. But my question is going to be, and time will tell, does it have equal effectiveness? And expediting the process is not a satisfactory thing if it's not effective. But that was an enormously effective. I'll tell you how effective it was. And I'm nervous every time I say this, but I say it because it's God's truth. Not a single person who has gone through that entire process has ever drunk again, and I've been doing them for several years. Not a single one. Now, I don't think that's a magic bullet. I don't think there's anything radically new about that. I really believe that when I intensively practice these principles as a way of life, there is no room for failure. No room for failure. And so that's one thing of effectiveness, of just of the many, many things that can be done. Newcomer meetings that can do an effective job of taking new people and helping them understand something about what this activity is all about. The singles of purpose, my buddy last night did a wonderful job, a well-articulated presentation on singles of purpose. And I just want to kind of underline that a little bit, and because it is a huge problem. And it's a thing that I want to have better understanding about than I do. I'm not up for grabs on it. I've got a very strong position that I hold today, and it won't change easily. But at the same time, I'm not blind. My God, I can see what's happening. And my concern is that we're not dealing with it very well. Just generally speaking, we're not dealing with it very well. Yeah, I have the privilege, great privilege, of traveling all over the place. And without exception, almost every place I go, how on the agenda of things we worry about is singleness of purpose. There are large areas of this country that have given up any pretense of singleness of purpose, don't even use the words. Well, I just believe that's fraught with a lot of peril when we start taking that kind of a move, and my buddy spelled it out darn well. Let me say it a little bit differently than he said it, but it's saying the same thing. When I look at singleness of purpose, and why was it I'm alarmed? It doesn't have to do with my personal preferences for who I hang out with. God, I could care less. It doesn't have to do with that. It has to do with the integrity and vitality of our program. What happened in Akron, Ohio, when Bill and Bob met, was here was a decrepit stockbroker and a rundown doc, both of them on their last legs. The stockbroker had found a vision he didn't understand very well, but he fervently believed, and he developed a real intense thing about the solution that he'd found. So he got this doc, and they sat down and talked. And among the things that Dr. Bob said was, finally, somebody understands. What formed that day was the basic tenet of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the basic tenet of what we're doing here this morning. That's the basic tenet of the International Convention. We never do anything more important nor more noble than one alcoholic opening up and sharing with another. And what was formed that day was an ethic, a belief that when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic gut level, something happens that had never effectively happened in the history of the world. It has a unique value. Well, what it comes down to, folks, is this with me. And why I stand as firmly as I stand, where I stand. I believe that tenet. And that tenet is either right or it's wrong. It either matters greatly or not at all. If it's right, then every one of us sitting here today, if you're an AA member, every one of us has an absolute responsibility to defend that ethic for the next, that tenet for the next person who walks into this room looking for the trusting environment, trustworthy environment of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's our responsibility. We, none of us, have the authority, we may have the recklessness, but none of us have the authority to reshape a program of which we're just one member. And I'll guarantee you, I'm not going to be the one who says, well, that doesn't really matter. It'll be all right. You're close enough. Just lie about it for a while. Maybe you'll catch it. You know, that's not good enough for me. If that tenet's not true, then it doesn't matter. It couldn't matter less. That fat lady with the ice cream is just as welcome as could be in a closed meeting. That either is true or it's not. That's an understanding. And what I would like to ask everybody here to do is not just decide what you think at the pop quiz level, but search your own conscience about that. Search your own conscience. Do you really believe that tenet is vital to the health and well-being and effectiveness of AA? If you do, you will probably take some action. And I'm not talking about being nasty to people. I'm talking about just having a real purpose for which. See, that principle is, it doesn't determine what we are not for. It determines what we must support and maintain. It is my duty, accepted duty, to be sure that the next person who walks in this room gets as good as I was given. That's my duty. If I don't do that, then I'm abdicating responsibility. So when you start looking for understanding and effectiveness, there's lots of places to look. Lots of places. That's just a couple of them. I tell you one last thing I'd say about that. That in order to accommodate folks who are not quite alcoholic, in order to accommodate folk in AA, we have to compromise the program. We have to compromise the integrity of the program. And I would submit to you that you can't compromise the integrity of the program to fit the individual peculiarities of the people walking in the door. If you do, we lose our purpose. What needed to change when I walked in these doors was me, not the group. And so that kind of issue is deeply embedded in that simple sounding little thing. If I hope that you'll give serious thought to that, and do whatever you can in that thing, because it really truly is. Well, I said I wasn't going to say one more thing, but I'll add one more, no extra charge. You mentioned a group in New York. I don't know how many places I go in this country when I look for some of my old buddies who have deserted the home base of Alcoholics Anonymous in a city. To me, that's almost kind of holy ground, you know, the place where the thing started. And it just seemed like it ought to have a pivotal role in how AA grew around it. In many places, old-timers have simply walked away. Didn't just die off. They just simply walked away. Moved to the suburbs, whatever. You know, but it's just that thing of conditions becoming so inappropriate and uncomfortable that they just leave. And that's what I mean by abdicating. And so a troubling kind of thing. It looks like I'm going to take 2 hours on just one paragraph. But that's why I told you we'll quit anyway, whether we get through or not. I'd rather do one thing thoroughly than see Europe in 21 days. The other thing that I just want to draw your attention to, if you probably already have your attention drawn, but I'd like to just rustle it anyway. It's the strange kind of a developmental process in AA that's occurring. And the other, if you can remember it, the other advantage of being old is, if you can remember it, are the changes that have occurred in the fellowship, in the character of the fellowship. In those early days when our time was spent not in studying books and learning all of the infinitives that go with the first step, it wasn't in that. You know, it was in action, in intensive work with other alcoholics. The program was a program of action. The intimacy and the fellowship and the sense of belonging was profoundly important in the fellowship. And over the years, we have moved in a different direction with that. And, you know, certainly you could tie it into the advent of treatment, because treatment had a lot of effects on Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of them would look good. For instance, if you're concerned about the support of our expenses in Alcoholics Anonymous, at one point, a good share of them came from the treatment industry. Now, we went for, 25 years before we ever sold a million big books. That was, for a number of years, we sold almost a million a year. But guess who bought them? Guess who bought them? You've heard of the $30,000 big book. Yeah. So that's where a tremendous amount of stuff, there's some things happened. There was a stimulation in the increase, I won't say of groups, but of meetings that grew out of that. There was a lot of impact on language, on terminology, on how we see ourselves in groups. A lot of things happened. The one that causes me some concern, and is not just owing to the advent of treatment, but that's certainly a major contributor. But what happened is we started to move almost definitively away from well-ordered, purposeful, structured groups into casual gatherings or meetings, which are not really groups at all. They were just, I mean, there's no pass-fail on this thing. It's a continuum. You know, you've got everything from, you know, like I belong to a strong, purposeful group. I know that some of you do. I'm specific and pacific. I know many of you belong to strong, purposeful groups. That's where I belong. That's where my group is. Now, that's one kind of a group. That's the one where I want to belong. But that group is no better than any other down the continuum. They all function under the banner of Alcoholics Anonymous. And just because something doesn't shape up and conform to our model doesn't mean that it's not just as legitimate as my home group. Hey, we've got probably the most generous... We got the most generous qualification for membership you could possibly have. If you say you're a member, you're a member. No committee, no resume, no Rorschach test. You just, if you say you're in, you're in. You stay there till you either quit or drink, whichever comes first. Your history either way. And so it's easy. Groups are just as easy. Anytime two or more alcoholics join together for the purpose of recovery, they can call themselves an AA group, as long as they don't have hooked into something else, you know, another affiliation. Is that loose or what? I mean, if we wanted to form a group at Whiskey Pete's whose purpose was to provide a counterculture for people who didn't like structure or who didn't like the service work in Alcoholics Anonymous, they could legitimately call themselves an AA group and nobody going to shut them down. So it's not a matter of pass-fail, it's a matter of where do we lose the vitality, or do we lose it? Where do we lose the things that are important? Now, I'll just let you in on this little secret if you hadn't already picked it up. Among the few concerns that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous, my greatest one is the one I'm talking about right now. Because that's the infrastructure of the program. That's where members are born and grow and develop. And if you take a look along that continuum all the way down to the end where it's a casual gathering with no leadership, you know, there are places that have absolutely no structured leadership whatsoever. The meeting just occurred. It happens when the people walk in, and its value extends for the life of that meeting, and then it's over, and that's all there is to it. Now, I would submit to you that to deal with the formidable problems that we confront in dealing with alcoholics, that ain't enough. If you start looking at a fellowship that reaches around the world, where does leadership come from? How much leadership are you going to get out of that kind of a gathering? What you'll find most of the time is a one-dimensional program. It has to do with me and how am I doing. And that's all. That's all. Pretty hard to treat a self-centered condition by focus on self. Don't think that flies too well. And so that's my biggest concern. I think that bodes most ill for the future, and it's one of the concerns. I hope that you'll give some thought to that, because those things will resolve when the conscience of the fellowship moves effectively. And that's why I'd like to talk about this kind of a thing some, because I think it's vital to our health and well-being. I'll say one other thing that sort of talks about group and it also goes back to singleness purpose a little bit. My home group one night, a guy came up to me and said, "Tom, we need to do a group inventory." Now, that's an unusual request. Very few people ask for a group inventory. And I said, "Why is that?" And he said, "Well, we've got too many addicts in here." And I swear to God, I knew that I'm kind of addle-pated sometimes. I really hadn't quite caught on what he was talking about. I said, "Well, let me take a look and see if I see the same thing." And what it was, somebody was loading up a bunch of kids from an adolescent center and bringing them over. You know, most of our wounds are self-imposed. They're not inflicted on us. They're mostly self-imposed. And what was happening, these kids were coming over there, and my God, those kids didn't know if they're alcoholics or goats. Good God, they're just... They're just kids, you know, crazy kids. And so they come in, and our guys, in their zeal to make them feel welcome, were involving them in a meeting. So you'd have a 14-year-old child that was no alcoholic at all up conducting a meeting. Yeah, and that's, you know, AA meetings are run by AA members. That's a given. You know, it was not always a given, but it's a truism that meetings are run by members. That's what we're doing. So we said, "All right, let's talk about that." We pulled a little group together, talked about it, and they said, decided two actions. One, we'd go over and talk to the director of the house, and asked me to do that. And I said, "Sure, do it." Went over, nice lady, good MSW. And so I talked with her. Couldn't have been more cooperative. She nobody had ever told her that we had such things as an open and closed meeting. They don't teach that in social work school. We just sort of pompously assume that everybody knows. Well, everybody doesn't know. And so the minute I told her about it, she said, "Oh, my God, yes, I didn't know about that. There's no problem. We'll deal with that." But that's not good enough, because when you're running a place with a bunch of wild ones running around like that, you're not going to put a lot of order and discipline in that. So we started something. This has been 25 years ago. We started something. We set up a newcomer program that met at the same time as our regular meeting, and it dealt with newcomer stuff. And we limited it to the first 3 months of sobriety. And what that gave us, we made it an open meeting. And what that gave us was an environment in which we could, without a lot of caustic interaction and all of this stuff, we could reasonably help those young folks figure out where they needed to go. And by the way, took in a lot of members in the process too. It wasn't just for the wayward folk. But, you know, when people are coming out of treatment facilities, a lot of times we overrate the quality of the preparation. You know, what treatment does is lowers the barriers enough that somebody can come to AA. It gives not one day of recovery in the world. And when somebody walks in out of a treatment center, I don't care which one it is, they're a brand new member of Alcoholics Anonymous and need the same kind of orientation, guidance that a brand new person does. And so what that's done is, for the past 25 years, I haven't been in a group that hadn't had a strong newcomer program. It invariably is one of the most important tools we have. It's simply a way to look at a problem, look at how can we take that, understand that problem enough to do something effective about it. That's what I like. I like to be in a world where we're making things work and not just criticizing what exists. You know? And so that's the whole message of that. We're through one half page of step 10. I just didn't want you to get lost in that. And I'm just going to sprint to the finish on that and just move over to 11 a little bit. And we're all right. We're not even close. The other thing that I just visit for a minute that is not, it may be live or die stuff. A place in that second part of that 10th step that's it's almost like a mixed message in a way. Because when you read through it, if you're a super optimist like me, you can really jump to some conclusions that are dangerous to your health in this thing. You know, like in the first paragraph up there, see, we're talking about the new attitude that comes when we start getting focused and getting into the program, start getting recovery. And we'll see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. And of course, discounting the first 9 steps, that has a little contributing fact. It just comes, you know, it just descends from manna. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality. I said that from memory. Oh, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. That sucker's gone. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. Now, that'd be some really whoopee kind of news, wouldn't it? Man, that dude's gone, just like a lobotomy. It's gone. We got a whole new head there. But read the bottom line. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. And the minute I'm not in fit spiritual condition, all bets are off. It's easy to let up on the spiritual. I'm going to read these 2 paragraphs just to frame that a little bit. Easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. Sure it is. What's a laurel? That's an accomplishment. I can take a look. My God, man, I've been doing this almost 49 years. I ought to just quit and let somebody else do it. Well, I don't give up quite that easy. I was in my group one night, and I'd been on the road for a while, and I'm still working now. I'm unemployed now. Pitiful case. And I'd come in and I just do stuff there. You know, I grabbed a coffee pot. I just felt like washing a coffee pot. So I'm over washing it. A young girl came up to me. She said, "Why are you washing that pot?" I said, "My God, girl, that thing was dirty. I mean, that dude was dirty." And she said, "Well, that's my job." And I said, "Well, you're going to have to get a little quicker on your job because..." I will get mine. Never mind. There's plenty of room at the doing place. But I'm going to do mine. I'm not going to let up on that spiritual condition nor the expressions of it in my life. And so it's easy. It is easy to let up on it. We're headed for trouble if we do. Alcohol is a subtle foe. We're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of that spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve you? Your will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise willpower as proper use of the will. You know, that very, very, very profound stuff in that, that as long as I stay in fit spiritual condition, man, I don't have to worry about booze. I can walk through Whiskey Pete's and I can go where they got booze or milkshakes. It doesn't matter. I just give it no thought. I'll tell you one little story about diligence and how easily stuff can happen. Now, this is no trauma, but I was changing planes somewhere and I was kind of rushing from one concourse to another and I really wanted a coffee. I wanted a Starbucks, couldn't find one. But I was looking for a coffee and I saw a place open as I just ducked in, and it was a bar. Now, I mean, I don't go into shock when I walk into a bar, but we've got it everywhere. But I walked in, saw what it was. It didn't look like it didn't like a coffee place. And a waiter walked by carrying a tray of drinks. And I looked at that, and I said, "Geez, that's a nice presentation." Well, now that's not 911 stuff. unless you're a guy like me, because I could take a simple, little, innocent, innocuous thought like that and play that sucker out. And man, first thing you know, I'd be in Rio de Janeiro somewhere. I mean, that my mind has no business there. I don't need to be having friendly thoughts about booze, nor angry thoughts about booze. I need to be having no thoughts about booze. Now, that wasn't decided, but it just shows how easily you get that little chink, and sometimes that's all it takes is a little chink, and then that dude will grow, and then watch what happens. And so, 10, you know, 10's an enormous action step, as you might gather from at least my view of the thing. And then we move into it. Now, that didn't even take an hour. I tell you, man, I am good. I am really quick. And I did that in Southern, too. And that's slow motion. These whole steps, you know, a lot of times we do them a great disservice and refer to them as maintenance steps. I think they're the most powerful action steps in the program because they spell out definitively how to get out of that studying my own case and taking my pulse every 30 minutes. It gets me out of that mode and into the action mode of carrying this message and making this thing come alive. And that's what it's about. You know, that stuff that Sharon treated so beautifully about getting that wreckage out of the way so we're free to breathe free and engage in life. And that's what these steps do. Say, okay, you've done that, now let's go to work. And 11 is not about going up on the mountain and bringing back tablets or anything like that. It's nothing heavy or deep. It's as deep as you want to go. But it's not mystical. You know, it's a very sensible kind of a thing to do. That what it calls for is that's really great. Give me the first one. Sought through prayer and meditation. Listen, man, I'm 84 years old. I don't believe that. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Yeah, I think that step is loaded with invitations, and not only invitations, but drive toward service. I really believe that's what's spelled out in that thing. Now, certainly it has to do with having a sound, working spiritual life. That's core. That's fundamental. I'm somebody who believes, like it says in the book, the spiritual life, it's God's everything or nothing. The spiritual life is the way we live, or there is no spiritual life. If I don't practice the spiritual life in everything I do, then there's nothing to it. And so it's part and parcel of everything I do. It's what drives my life. It's what gives me what I need. But I have to continue to nurture that relationship and develop that relationship. Now, I'll tell you how simple that is for me and how that translates into action. I don't know if my wife's in here or not, but if she's not, don't tell her this. I'm a great lover of water. If you've ever been and worked with y'all with me, I always like to talk about this. I've always loved water. And you can tell that. And one of my favorite places to get just for reflection or meditation or getting into some spiritual thoughts or whatever, or just sort of taking it easy. I just love to get my water, particularly running water. And I'd always had this kind of desire to have a pond out behind my house. Well, my wife had no interest in a pond. And she keeps my money locked up a lot. And so I gave her a pond for her 33rd wedding anniversary. She said, gee, thanks, big guy. I finally let her feed the fish. I thought she was going to poison them for a while. But I mean, you sometimes just a little manipulation is spiritual, I think. So I got that pod, and that's where I do my best preparation. That's for, and every day that I can, and it doesn't have to be, my God, I do it on airplanes, I do it walking down the street. I mean, it doesn't require some special place and robes and smoke and incense and all that junk. I mean, that's fine if you want to do that, but I'm not me, man. I got stuff to do. I'm going to get around in a trance. So, so what I do in the morning, I like to go out there and just sort of sit there. And I watch those fish just busy being fish. And listen to that waterfall, you know, that thing just gurgling and gurgling. It's just a wonderful, soothing, peaceful feeling. And I don't know if everybody's like this or not, but I imagine most folks are. Brain is an active thing, even if it's not loaded with intelligence. It's a busy thing. And when I start to do that, man, my mind is going a mile a minute. You know, and I'm not thinking heavy-duty spiritual thoughts. I'm thinking, oh, gee, well, I'm supposed to call that guy, and I'm supposed to be over that thing, man. So I just have to listen a while just to sort of get quiet and let my brain settle down. And then it's not routinized to the point of ritual. I don't do exactly the same thing, but essentially what I do every day is I talk to my higher power. And I sit there and I listen a lot, and I just kind of reflect and meditate and get my things together. And then when I'm ready to pray, what I basically do is about three things. One, every day I wanna reflect on who I am. Who am I? Yeah, I'm not some big deal flying all around the world. That's not who I am. I'm an alcoholic. I have an absolutely fatal, incurable illness. I have an illness that the overwhelming majority on this planet die of, never really knowing there's a way out. Some in this country, some in countries where it has never been heard of. So I reflect on that I'm not somebody just sort of casually sauntered into Alcoholics Anonymous. Or somebody kind of drugged me in here, tried to brainwash me. No. I'm a guy with a hopeless condition. And why on earth I wound up here, I don't waste time thinking about. Because I could never figure it out. You know, we think we're a pretty big crowd till we think of the scope of the world population. If you think about in terms like that, we are barely a blip on the radar screen. We're such a tiny percentage of the alcoholics. And so I like to reflect on that. That man, for whatever reason, I've been given a gift beyond estimate. Beyond estimate. given a life that surpasses anything I could have ever imagined. And I'll guarantee you deserving is not in my vocabulary. So I reflect on that. And when I do that, I get properly geared. And that's not morbid. That's just a reality check. This is who I am. This is fundamentally who I am. Those are bottom line things with me. And when I am real solid inside, I'm pretty doggone tough outside. So I like to get real well fixed in that. Doesn't take long. Doesn't take long at all. And then when I do, I pray that I will let the way I carry myself during the day reflect the gratitude that I have for the gift that I've been given. My God, is that a no-brainer? I mean, how could I take a priceless gift and then just say, oh, well, you know, I'm sober and putting up with stuff. Baloney. Yeah. I'm somebody who's been given a gift. And because of that, I want to wear that gift well. I want to be somebody who reflects the value of sobriety. I want to be somebody that folks could take a look at and say, you know, I wouldn't mind doing what that guy does. I don't want somebody to look at me and say, for God's sake, if that's what it is, I don't want it. No, I can't quite see it that way. You know, I want to reflect that gift. I want to be, I'll never be worthy of it, but I want to be as worthy as I can. I want to be mindful of the value of that gift. And then, the other thing I pray for not for opportunity, but I pray to be sensitive to opportunities to be of service. And I tell you something, you will travel very few yards before you see somebody that need of service. It's not always money or physical assistance. Sometimes a kind word is priceless. Greeting. Smile, for God's sakes. Yeah, just simple little things. Yeah, and if I'm not sensitive to those things, I'll walk right past gross need and not even see it. But if I'm sensitive to it, sometimes I'll pick up on it. Very often, I'll pick up on it. And so that's what I want to do. Yeah, what that does is that shapes the way I try to live every day of my life. And I'm no paragon of virtue or humility or excellence or anything like that. I'm just another human being. But I treat every person that I meet, everybody, like a lady or a gentleman. I don't care what they are, because it isn't about them. It's about me. Now, everybody I meet is not a lady or a gentleman. I meet a jerk once in a while, but I'll tell you the darn truth, darn few. I meet darn few jerks. And I certainly got enough sense to get away from one. Yeah, I don't hang out with people that have got nothing to do but chop up and gossip and beat people up. I have no time for that. I don't want to invest any of my attention to garbage like that. And so that's the way I go through my life and try to handle myself. And so what that does just gives me absolutely marvelous, marvelous experiences that just defy imagination. I tell you just a couple of things that come out of that. And I already told you I'm a manipulator, but I don't think I do that for manipulative purposes. That I don't really need to. There's enough spontaneous response. You don't need to sort of hoodoo people. I tell you the kind of thing that happens routinely with me. I'll give you a real fresh one. My wife is a person. She's not here. I'm going to chance it. She's not here. My wife likes to sin a little. And that's one reason I bring her to Las Vegas, because she likes to come out here and sin big time. She keeps on, I won't buy any more ponds, I'll tell you that. She's pretty good at it, really. And we came a couple of days early, and we got a fly. I never had stayed over at this particular hotel. I won't put their business on the street, but they probably wouldn't mind. I won't do it anyway. We checked into this place, and it's a nice hotel. I'd never stayed there. And we had booked a suite, and it had a really great price on it. And so when we checked in, I got to kidding around with a girl from Texas, you know, and Clancy, she was from Big Springs, Texas. What? I told her, I said, girl, that place is famous. Man, you are the home of the state nut house. And she said, really? I said, yeah, really? So we just got kidding around, you know. She had a whole bunch of wild tourists just crambling all over the place trying to get to the machines or something. And so we just kidded around a little bit. And she gave us... If she upgraded us to a suite that was $150 more than the one we had. And I didn't ask for it. I mean, we had a suite that had if it wasn't the best one in that hotel, it would have certainly been with the best one. We had a view of Las Vegas. Man, you could see the Colorado. It was absolutely marvelous, just marvelous. And it had nothing to it. She said, I can't give you to this thing, but one night, so I stopped by the next day, and I told the girl, I said, now, I know I'm supposed to move, but it won't make me mad if I don't move. We didn't move. I mean, man, we live like King Tut over there. It just happens all the time. I'll tell you, what happens when you get into a deal like that. It's a spiritual condition. Tell you, first time I ever got it into focus and kind of understood what was happening in my life when I tried to practice that kind of stuff. I was at O'Hare one day in Chicago. I was on the way to February, and I'm on the way to Fargo, North Dakota. And we got some fine young Turks from Fargo here that really glad to see those guys. I'm going to visit them this spring. But I was on the way to Fargo in February, and I'll assure you that is no thrill. No thrill. And so I'm walking down the concourse at O'Hare, and I realized I was grinning. Well, you don't grin in airports. I mean, nobody grins in airports. Man, they'll put a net on you if you start grinning in there. You know, there's an airport persona. You've got to be mad, and you got to be focused, and you got to be demanding. Well, I'm going down there, grinning down the concourse, and when I realized it, I almost wanted to blush. You know, I felt embarrassed that I'm grinning, and so I put on my game face and kept walking. But then I got thinking about that. Why on earth am I grinning? You know, I'm in O'Hare. And I just hate wandering around that, well, charging through that place. And I'm grinning. Now, why in the world was I grinning? There was a guy that some of you might have heard of from North Carolina, a fine young man named Michael Jordan, who played a little bit of Sandlot basketball and achieved some notoriety. He was. I know everybody in the world remembers this thing. I'm going to remind you of. He was playing a game one day against somebody, and he was one of those blind days. You know? He could throw it over his shoulder from mid court, blindfolded, and it'd go. I mean, he was missing nothing. And at one point, he finished a goal. And he was trotting down the court, and he looked over at the opposing bench, and he gave it that, don't ask me, man, don't ask me. And later on, he described his makeup that day as being in a zone. And that term caught on. It's still widely in use. And when I thought about why was I grinning in Chicago, that's what I was. I was in a zone. I was in a zone. Where I'm just on a spiritual, just a spiritual kind of a place, and it came down to three things. One, I was exactly who I'm supposed to be. That same guy I'm talking about out by the pond, that's who I was. I was exactly who I'm supposed to be. No sham, no pretense, no pushing people around. I am who I'm supposed to be. And I'm where I'm supposed to be. I'm on the way to Fargo, North Dakota to try to carry the message to some fellow alcoholics. That's where I'm supposed to be. And I was doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. That produces a zone. That's the spiritual life when it's really clicking and everything's on go. And in that kind of a deal, amazing things happen. That happened to me on a golf course one time. That never has happened again, but I was playing. I used to play not good, but pretty decent. And I was playing one day just practicing, and a guy sponsored an older fella and my age was playing over there and another older fella. And so I went over, and he said, come play with us. And I said, okay, fine. I went over and played with him. Well, my God, I mean, the poor guys couldn't hit it out of their shadow. And so I'm just kind of laying back, you know, just sort of easily going along. I got on the eighth hole, and I realized I was 3 under par. I birdied the next hole, which put me 4 under par. And for non-golfers, that means 4 strokes better than the course was supposed to play when you play it just right. That means good. That usually means payday for a pro. And that when I walked in, I learned I had tied the course record. So I'm eating my obligatory hot dog, and I'm thinking to myself, "You wait till I get on that back nine, man. I am going to beat this sucker. I'm bringing this course to his knees." You know, I almost set the course record the other way when I took over. I lost, I was, well, it won't mean much to God, but I was 15 strokes worse with me in charge. And, but it does something, because that, and that's all it was. When I was in that zone, I wasn't straining, wasn't doing anything. I was just kind of naturally staying within my limits and all that. And things just work well. It's the same way with life. You know, if I can just get tuned in, plugged in, so that I'm just naturally following the power that guides me, my God, amazing things happen. Yeah, in Portland, I could tell you a thousand of these, man. I would love to. Up in Portland a while back, I had a double header. I was going to be in Portland 1 week and Vancouver 1 week and Portland the next. So I thought we'd be smart, and got the madam. She knew the casino was up there too. And so we went to Portland, got a car, drove to Vancouver, and then back. And it was cheaper for everybody. And it was wonderful for us. So we took. And when we went in to check in to get a car, now you know how it is checking in cars at airports. You know, you might as well be talking to a robot. I mean, they're not going to pay too much attention to who's there. So there was a little girl there, and we just started visiting a little bit and messing around. I couldn't mess around much. The wife was right there watching every move. But just let's mess that. And this little girl said, I can't remember the name of this thing, but we had ordered a Yugo. I mean, we wanted a real bargain basement deal, so we ordered something we could barely get in. And so the little girl checks in. She said, "Would you do me a favor?" I said, "Yeah, what?" She said, "Will you take an Oldsmobile something that's one of those big old tall SUV things that they charge a ton for?" And I said, "Oh God, people always want me to do stuff." And I said, all right, I'll do it. I'll help you out." She said, "Man, I really appreciate that." Well, my God, here's a luxury car at the same price. Same price. Call it serendipity. I call it a product of just the way you carry yourself and how you present yourself. Just amazing stuff happens. And I'm not looking for that. But this world becomes a friendly place when I approach it in that spirit. It's amazing how that works. And so all that is to me is this thing of putting legs on prayer and meditation so that it starts to drive the way we live. You know, I mentioned the thing, I'll tell you one other story, and I love to tell stories. I can make a point easier with a story than I can philosophizing all day. It takes less time, too. I'll tell you one other one about what that does, and this thing of how I want to carry myself in the world. One day we were in the lobby of a Hampton Inn. We had some people in town, and we were going to put on a district workshop, and I was chairing the workshop. So we had everybody around the table, and we were fat-mouthed and planning the meeting. And I noticed, I wasn't paying attention, but I noticed there was an older couple beside us in the next table, and then they went over, checked out, and they came back to our table and stopped. And the lady was the more forward of the two. She recognized that I was chairing the meeting, so she said, she stopped, and I said, "Hello," and she said, "We didn't mean to be eavesdropping, but we were." And said, "Do you mind telling me what you folks are doing?" I said, "No, not at all. No, we're planning a meeting. We're going to be doing a meeting downtown here in a little while, and we're planning a meeting." And she said, "What's it about?" And I said, "It's about service." She said, "That's good. And in relation to what?" And I said, "Alcoholics Anonymous." And she said, "Man, that's wonderful." And then she said, "We had been remarking to each other that you guys were the most intensely focused people we had ever seen doing what was obviously a kind of a little meeting." And I thought later how much I appreciated it. Thank God I wasn't just telling dirty jokes. You know, thank God I wasn't just trying to see who could outcuss who. Thank God, if I'm going to do my business in public, or if I'm going to let my activities at Alcoholics Anonymous get observed, thank God that this was one time. I guarantee you that woman and that man would have recommended the Pope to Alcoholics Anonymous without hesitation. Let me contrast that to a different thing. It's not always that way. I was at a conference, and the madam was with me. I was out at a conference out in Tennessee. And sometimes things just don't go well. Now, this one went well. You can relax now, Bob. That one didn't. And they on Saturday night, they had a guy speaking. I was on Sunday morning, and they had a guy. My specialty is closing down parties. I mean, I put an end to a lot of parties. They had this guy on Saturday night, and he thought he was supposed to be a stand-up comedian. I'd never seen him before or since, thank God. And the poor fella was going all out, but he was not funny at all. And you know how it is when you're going down the pipe. You just start scrambling and clutching at straws, you know. And so the harder he tried, the worse he got. And good God, he got not only X-rated, this guy got profane and vulgar and disgusting. And I just happened to be sitting behind the lady who was the program chair, the one who invited the speakers. And there was a man sitting beside her. And I was just fascinated with that guy's neck, because it just looked like a thermometer. You know, you could just see it. It could get red, and his ears were glowing. And I said, uh-oh. And so after the meeting, I found her, and I said, your friend didn't seem to enjoy that meeting too much. And she said, Tom, you'll never know how embarrassed I am. She said, I have never been more humiliated in my life. That guy was her minister, attending his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll absolutely guarantee you it was his last meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That dude wouldn't have recommended AA. He'd have recommended somebody to hell before he would AA. See what I'm talking about? That, you know, that was just one of those unfortunate things that happens. But you never know. It's like when I'm speaking to a group, I'm a pretty clean guy. Yeah, I'm a pretty clean guy when I'm not speaking to a group. But I particularly am when I'm speaking to a group, because I don't know who's here. You may have your mother here. You may have your child here. This is an open conference. And I'm not going to embarrass you or humiliate you or make you feel ashamed of the fellowship you belong in. I'm going to try to be an example. If you ask me to be an example and to share experience, I'm going to try to do that in a dignified kind of a way. I have a good time. But I'll guarantee you, I'm not going to get off the wall and push you up to your limits on what your tolerance is. I'm going to try to be an example. So a lot of good stuff happens in that thing of taking this spiritual life and really putting it to play as a way. You know, I believe in the 11th step. If I take this conscientiously, if I take the action of the 11th step conscientiously, I think what it does is that it will open the avenue to an area of service that is right for you. I think there's an avenue of service that's right for everybody. I believe that whoever you are, I believe that there's somebody needs to hear your story. Not mine, yours. And I think this 11th step is what opens the door and starts to generate this movement into service. And if you've got a heart to serve, it'll open up for you. God knows what it'll be. I was making a talk down on the coast of North Carolina a while back. And I was talking about CPC, Cooperative Professional Community. And after the meeting, there was a fellow, and I just, as a matter of course, I knew what the answer was going to be. I said, by the way, I didn't define CPC. I just said it. And I said, by the way, would all of you who are involved in CPC, and there are about 200 people in the room, just raise your hand so I can get a feel for the kind of action you got going. One person raised their hand out of 200. Well, after the meeting, a fellow came up to me and he said, Tom, I'd like to ask you about something. I said, yeah, what? He said, I've been sober 22 years and I'm ashamed to admit it, but I've never done any service whatsoever. And he said, I can't figure out what to do. I said, well, tell me what you did before you came into AA. What's your profession? What's your career? And he said, I'm a CPA, a certified public accountant. And I said, my God, man, they got dopes like me counting the money. Jesus, we got a place for you. Jesus, get in here. But everybody's got tools. Everybody's got talents. Everybody's got something to offer. They're not all the same. But this step will open the avenue of service. Now, I'll tell you what my belief is. This, you won't find this in a book anywhere, but this is stone my belief. I believe that when that avenue of service opens, it is critically important how I respond to it. When that comes, if I just selfishly or fearfully or whatever back off, I think there's a price tag on that. I think at a minimum, it will cost me in terms of the quality of my recovery. And I'm pretty well convinced it will affect the quantity of my recovery. You know, it just stands to reason that you can't intake but just so long. And then you got to have an outlet. I know you folks know the story, but I'll tell it again because I think it makes the point. Over in the Middle East, there's not where they're shooting at tomorrow. Well, they're not shooting today, but anyway, over in the Middle East, there's an area where there are two bodies of water within sight. Oh, not quite within sight of you, but there are two bodies of water in the same region of that part of the world, same climate. Same rainfall, everything's exactly the same, same temperature, all of it is exactly the same. One of those bodies of water supports no life of any kind. Not a blade of grass grows there. No fish lives in that water. It's called the Dead Sea. It's called it the Dead Sea because it's dead. It has absolutely nothing. And not far away, there's another body of water quite similar in nature. Obviously similar in terrain. That's blue and beautiful, and vegetation lives there, fish live there, it's brimming with fish, and that's called the Sea of Galilee. And the only difference is not some chemical deposit in the ground, it's that the Dead Sea has no outlet. What it does is store water, and if you store water and it has no outlet, what happens? It becomes brackish and then foul, and then nothing lives. The Sea of Galilee is a channel. It's a channel. It's a beautiful body of water, but it takes water in and puts water out. And I think that's exactly the same with a member. That if all I do is think about me, 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 God, it just stands to reason there's going to come a saturation point. I mean, my God, how many times are you going to be thrilled over talking about gratitude or listening to Tom I? You know, you got to find a way to be an active conduit of this life-saving process and not a storage place. Yeah. And I think that's where 11 has an awful lot to do with getting into the business of living. I do want to visit 12 just a little bit. Make sure I don't want to skip something I really wanted to talk about. I think I've covered it adequately. What I was talking, wanted to talk about being open and available. You know, being open and available to this kind of thing of opportunities to be of service. Anonymity, and our county incorporates this into 12. Anonymity can be a barrier. If not well understood, and I would suggest to you that anonymity is not a well understood principle in this program. Awful lot of confusion about it, and anonymity. I had the great privilege of hearing Bill speak several times. You never did hear him once, but I went to my first international in Toronto in '65, and He led a meeting, and he was talking about traditions. He was talking about anonymity, and he said something that had profound meaning for me at that time. I was probably sober 8 years or so, 8 years, and it had a lot of meaning for me. He was describing tradition, and he got to anonymity. And he said one thing that is important to understand is that Alcoholics Anonymous was never intended to be some furtive hiding place for alcoholics. This is not some place where we create a subterranean culture and we're going to live there in this stringent privacy and guarded kind of notion about the world. He said the function of this program is to restore us to our rightful place in society. the rightful place in this world. Not to make us hide out and find. Sometimes we imprison ourselves behind a glass prison of anonymity. That's more an expression of fear or pride or anxiety or something, not anonymity. And so awfully important to understand a distinction that anonymity, the heart and soul of anonymity is humility. It's about doing something without recognition. It's about not taking credit. It's not, tell you, it's a tricky thing to get. I was in a professional conference one time when I was employed. And the break time, a young lady and I were just walking around drinking coffee, and you know how you do at professional conferences, just how do you do stuff, and what's your name, and what's your dog's name, and all this stuff, and how many kids. So we're going through that routine, and all at once she said, "Are you Tom I?" I always told her my name's Tom Ivester, gave him a social security number, everything, man. I'd done it all. "Are you Tom I?" I said, "Well, in some circles, that's how I'm known." And she said, "I know you." And what it was, you jump ahead and know what it was. She'd been listening to some tapes, and she recognized the voice. And I thought, this is quite a commentary on anonymity. I have to use my full identity to be anonymous. Tom, oh yeah, I don't know Tom Ivester. It's a strange kind of thing to understand. And so sometimes you get so caught up in the thing that you can't function very well. And it's not about that. It's about protecting against that ego. It's about not making heroes out of people. It's not about glamorizing. I think my buddy said something one time that, and I think it's so true, that anonymity breaks are rarely, they're about three basic things. One's ignorance. I mean, people just don't know the difference. But the two more fatal ones are either pride or money. You know, some grandiose notion that if I let word out that a guy like me's in this program, it'll encourage others to come. It'll also encourage some to go somewhere else. And that's what I have to remember. Or money. We've got an awful lot of people who really walk a tight wire between avocation and vocation in AA. And it's tremendously important in the thing of anonymity. I've had people, I'm sure a lot of you have been asking me for years, "Man, you ought to write a book." Well, I'm not so sure I should. Well, I haven't done it, so apparently I'm not too sure I should. But I've got some real, what on earth says the whole world needs to hear me? Or everybody needs to hear my thoughts. You know, I don't think that's necessarily my purpose. And so anyway, it's a tricky kind of a thing that can have allure if you're not careful about the thing. And so I'm as loose as can be in some areas. If anybody doesn't know I'm in AA, they've probably been in a cave somewhere because, I mean, I am open with it at one level. But I'm extremely guarded with it. You know, I've done some movies and television and radio, but never without an absolute assurance of anonymity, because that's where it starts to get into big-time trouble. But at the personal level, at the community level, even with my neighbors, stuff like that, you know, I'm not going to hide in some veil of fear that's not necessary. You know, and so I do a lot of stuff. I'll give you an example of that. I'd spent a lot of time on airplanes, and for a lot of years, it wasn't deliberate, for a lot of years, people chat about sort of nonsensical stuff, you know, just talking away, and for a lot of years, people would say, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going to Prim, Nevada." They said, "My God, what for?" But they'd always say, "What for?" And I wouldn't particularly lie, but I'd be evasive, yeah. And I wasn't, I mean, I just hadn't thought it through, and I wasn't just petrified by saying what for, but I would kind of fog it a little bit. You know what I mean? I'd say, "Oh, it's a conference." "Oh, what kind of conference?" I say, "Well, it's about alcoholism." "Well, this is not about alcoholism. This is about new life. This is about the history of alcoholism, but it's about living. It's about the joy of life, yeah." And so that's not right. And then one day I was on a plane, And I thought to myself, why on earth do I do that? That's stupid. Yeah, here I am in a metal tube, 35,000 feet in the air. Good chance I may not even get there. You know, that I'm just shotting around. Protecting my anonymity? From what? And I thought, that is stupid. I'm not doing that anymore. And I haven't. Now, that's probably been many, many years ago. But if somebody is sitting with me and they ask me those fatal questions, they better want to know. Because I mean, I'll flat tell them. And I tell you the kicker to that. I have never, and I mean I've done it hundreds and hundreds of times, I have never had anyone demonstrate less than animated interest. Not a single person has ever said, oh, that's nice. Not a one. It's everybody's got one. My God, they're in every family tree. Everybody is interested in this thing. Sometimes it's the guy sitting with me. There's a thousand spinoff stories from that. But it's just amazing how people respond with eager interest to learn about it, to know what it's about. And man, I'm going to tell you something. I've had more wonderful experiences with that than you could possibly imagine. They don't end. They're just absolutely uncanny. I'm going to tell you a few of them, then we'll head to the finish line. I'll pick one out of blue. Non-alcoholic. A lot of these are non-alcoholic, but I flying in one day to some airport, and I try to mind my own business, but the seats are close. And the guy sitting beside me, I was watching him, and his hands gripped at those armrests. I mean, you talk about white knuckling. I mean, that sucker didn't have any circulation, man. He was death grip on those armrests. So I was debating, do I mind my own business, or do I kind of butt in? And that's how I think I'll butt in. So I said, tough, ain't it? And man, I'm telling you, that guy just came on well. He said, my God, mister, you'll never know how tough this is. He said, I have to fly. I'm a salesman. I travel the entire country. I have to fly. It's the only realistic way I can get there. I've got to quit my job. And he said, every time we take off or land, I am absolutely terrified. Excuse me. And so, I told you that sometimes manipulation is not necessarily unspiritual. I didn't lie to the guy exactly. But thank God I have never been afraid on an airplane but one time for about 15 seconds. I don't know why. It's just one of those kind of uneasy things, and it's gone. And I said, I used to have that problem. I didn't tell him for 15 seconds. And he said, what did you do? And I said, well, I belong to a program, and we have a little prayer that we use routinely that's called the Serenity Prayer. I said, are you familiar with that? And he said, no, how does it go? And so I quoted him the Serenity Prayer. And he said, wait a minute. And he got out his little notepad. He said, say that again. I'm dictating the Serenity Prayer. Now, I don't know if that would help that guy. But boy, it sure didn't hurt anything, did it? See, they had an opportunity to reach out to a human being. Yeah, we try to be a maximum servant to God and those about us, not just the ones in DTs, to God and those about us. Now, that might have been a transforming moment for him. Who knows? But for me, it was just one more brick in the treasure house of rewards that make up my life. And so it's just something. And when I do my nightly deal with this thing, rarely, I mean rarely, do I entertain negative stuff about unfinished business or somebody that's mad or all that. Every night, just about, it is with deep, deep gratitude for the stuff that's gone in my life. Yeah, I mentioned Fargo a while back. I'll tell you another one. In fact, I think it was that same trip when I was grinning going down the airport. I think I was going, that was the trip. But when I finally got down there, I got the last seat on the last plane going to Fargo. They were just getting ready to shut down O'Hare. So I got on the plane, and being late, I got in the middle, and that is my worst dream realized when I'm sitting in the middle. Not for fat boys. And so I'm sitting in there, and there's a little girl sitting beside me, and she was she was from Boston, Massachusetts. We started to chat just a minute. And then right before we took off, the aisle seats open, and I'm saying, maybe I'm lucked out. And they saw this frantic-looking red-haired woman coming down the aisle, and I said, uh-oh, I believe that's mine. And sure enough, I mean, she just wild-looking. She came in and sat down in my seat. And so I said hi. And her name was Kit. She was from Providence, Rhode Island. And in the course of just howdy-do and stuff, she told me, I said, where are you headed? I knew where we were going. I said, you got family in Fargo, it brings you to Fargo. And what had happened, she had a tough situation. Her husband just died of brain cancer, a very difficult time, and she's going there for grief with her family. And so I'd been talking to the little librarian from Boston, and she told me she was going to Fargo to apply for a job as a librarian. She hadn't seen advertised, all she told me. Well, I got caught up talking to this lady here because there was a lot of trauma. And she asked me where I was going. I told her. And she said, my God, it looked like she just was hit with electricity. She said, are you in recovery? I said, you better believe I'm in recovery. And she said, me too, 7 years. Well, we don't mean to be rude, but we often are. And so when she's told that, I mean, we just started having a semi-closed meeting right there on that airplane, and we're just going at it. Yeah. And right before we got to Fargo, it dawned on me I was being pretty rude to the girl on the other side. And so I finally got through to me, and I said, oh, God, I want to apologize for being so rude. And I said, I didn't even talk to you since you've been on the plane. She said, no, please don't apologize. Everybody's got the rest of the story, eh? There's always the rest of the story for every one of us. She said, I didn't tell you the whole story. I said, oh, what's the story? She said, I was to be married last Saturday. And I went down to the church, had my gown on, all the wedding party was there. My groom didn't show up. That, and I never have been a stood-up bride, but that has got to be a devastating thing. She was humiliated, absolutely embarrassed to the core. And she said, I started looking at trade magazines just trying to figure someplace I could go to get a new start. And I didn't know if there was any hope for me to ever get a new start. She said, but listening to you guys, boy, is there ever hope for me. But isn't that something? Isn't that something? Yeah, I suppose I'd have been sitting there in my little glass prism. Don't tell nobody. Baloney. And my God, how many thousands and thousands of warm and wonderful experiences have I blocked out just by failing to open up and let somebody get into my life? And so, those are where the things that, to me, that bring this program alive big time. The book, I am going to quit just a little bit early, but it's step 12. One reason I won't deal with it, step 12, the way it's laid out in our book, there are two of the longest chapters in there. One's on working with others. The other's on wives. I don't know if there's any connection in that, but it's just the way it is. It's probably the most detailed manual of how to do something I've ever seen. It is an excellent manual. If you think you don't know how to do a 12-step work, read the book. Read the book. It will tell you exactly. It's almost a script for a 12-step call. If you don't know how to work with others, take a look at that thing. It'll guide you through it big time. Just a couple of areas that I want to visit in this is the all too familiar stuff that you hear a lot, the first two paragraphs. Perhaps our practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they're very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends, that is an experience you must not miss. We know you'll not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers, with each other, is a bright spot of our lives. Let me tell you just one little story, a 12-step story, and of many, but there's one. Sometimes you really think you're not equipped, you don't know what to do, and all this kind of stuff. I got a call a while back, a few years back, and I had no clue who it was. I grabbed a fairly new guy to take with me. We went over, and this fella was a major league high roller. He was a head of an international industry, and I didn't know him, but I mean, he was the kind of guy that was ready to tell me a lot about that, and so he told me. And when he got through, he said, "Would you like me to tell you a little about my background?" And I said, "Yeah, do it." So he said, "Well, I've been treated a lot." He said, "I just got out of a place that charged me $30,000. I've talked to every expert in the United States that I've ever heard of. And I guess that I've heard everything that people can say about this illness." He said, "The last person that did what you're doing here tonight ripped me off for $300,000. He said, "What do you suppose you can tell me that I haven't already heard?" Well, you know, in those promises it says we will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. I'm no boy genius, but just by instinctual reaction, I said, "Well, let me just tell you this. I probably can't tell you anything you hadn't heard, but let me tell you two things I want you to know. One, this man and me are here because we love you. We don't even know you, but we love you. And the other thing is, I wouldn't sell you 30 minutes of my time doing this for $300,000. That old boy got just as quiet as a fellow could get. Still sober. Still sober. It's just an intuitive thing. When you're genuinely trying to connect with another alcoholic, you find a way to do it. And, I was going somewhere. I was changing planes in DFW a while back. And, walking down the concourse, and I saw him and his wife standing over there. So I greeted him and said, "Where are you headed?" And he said, "Oh, we thought we'd go down to Acapulco for a few days and get some sun." "Where are you going?" I said, "Jockstrap, Missouri or somewhere." I said, "Man, there ain't no justice in this world." I guess. But I wouldn't trade places with him. No, I mean, I'm not against Acapulco, but I wouldn't trade places with him. Where I was going had a lot more meaning and purpose. And so it's just amazing stuff that happens in this business of actively getting involved in carrying this message. And there's one other place I wanted to just read a little thing. I appreciated Craig reading page 100 out of the book there, that both you and me, man, must walk. We read that at the closing of every one of our meetings, because I think it captures the spirit of what we do here better than anything I know, that we're not reaching down to help some poor and fortunate. So what we do is take a fellow alcoholic arm in arm, and we walk together. That's what we do. So that, to me, is the spirit of what this thing's about. On the 96, I know we're not cross-referencing this thing, but on 96 there's a little thing. It's an area, and I just visited a minute because it's a thing that causes a lot of consternation sometimes about how to deal with folk in those early days of recovery, because everybody comes in, everybody brings baggage. Everybody brings baggage. I don't care where they come from, penthouse or jailhouse, everybody brings baggage. And the dilemma is, how do you deal with that appropriately? If you've got a heart to help, you want to help. But in helping, it's critically important to do it at the right time and in the right way. You know, my group did a little workshop a while back on working with others. We broke it into four categories. First one was the classic 12-step call. How you make a 12-step call, and how do you involve the family in the process? Second was the baggage. How do you deal with the baggage that everybody brings? Ignore it? Condemn it? Whatever. You know, what do you do with it? Third one was, what do you do? And this one I want to hit at just a little bit. What do you do? Every one of us can recognize when somebody is headed for trouble. And we're all equally at a loss about what to do. If we beat that thing around, what we finally concluded, that the action to be taken would be taken by the person with the greatest level of trust. If you don't have that level of trust, you run the risk of doing more harm than good. If you've got the trust, there's no limit to what you can do. I've come to understand and believe that when you gain the trust of another alcoholic, it's a lifetime deal. A lifetime deal. It never goes away unless you violate it. It never goes away. I'm usually reminded about it about 3 o'clock in the morning when somebody I've worked with out here in California calls me, don't know what time it is. But when folks get in trouble, they'll reach back to what they trust. And it's amazing when you establish that thing. It's powerful. And there's no limit to what you can do when you've got that trust. Had a boy, old boy, sitting at my table one day, and now I'm a pretty nice guy, but I was talking to him like his mama wouldn't talk to him, because he needed it badly. I mean, and he was begging for it. So I laid on that boy pretty hard. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I've half killed people in bars for talking to me like that. He said, but I know you do it because you love me. True. True. So there was no harm I could do. But anyway, kind of an important thing about gaining the trust. And then those two areas that I just want to mention is before us boogie is the last one I said. It has to do with this thing about dealing with it, that baggage. I'll just read these couple of paragraphs and then comment and then say amen. When somebody comes in, he may be broke and homeless. If he is, you might try to help him by getting a job or giving him a little financial assistance. Nothing wrong with that. But you should not deprive your family or creditors of money they should have. Perhaps you'll want to take the man into your home for a few days, but be sure you use discretion. Be certain he will be welcomed by your family and that he's not trying to impose upon you for money and connections or shelter. Permit that and you only harm him. You'll be making it possible for him to be insincere. You may be aiding in his destruction rather than his recovery. And then the other one that just sort of echoes that is on 98. And it says this, and it's just the same way. It's not the matter of giving that's in question. Nothing wrong with that. But when and how to give is the real issue. That often makes the difference between success and failure. The minute we put our work on a service plan, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol till the material needs are cared for. Nonsense. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn the truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people. I'll tell you what that translates to me. It doesn't need much translation. But it translates into some action for me. If you haven't done 12-step work, you want to know what it really is like, reading that chapter, that little paragraph where it talks about all of the things that can potentially happen on a 12-step call, that is not prose. There is not one of those things that has not happened in my home and in my life. Not only once, but a few times. And so it is an interesting activity. And this whole business about knowing when to give. My experience has been that people who come into Alcoholics Anonymous almost invariably get what they came to get. almost invariably, I don't care what it is, job, wife, money, driver's license, almost always get it. And if the fundamental motivation is not to get sober, they almost always mark the occasion with a drink. And that's why it's so important about this thing of timing. I hate to use this kind of an example, but it's almost like behavior modification, you know, in a way. It's like Pavlov dogs. You know, if you give the, and I really hate to use that analogy, but if you give the dog the pellet before the trick, no trick. And if you give the drunk the boost in anticipation that it might help him, kiss him goodbye. Critically important to understand when the effort's being made and that what we're supporting is the actions of recovery and not the old habits of using and taking advantage of folk. And so it's a tremendously important area of 12-step work. It's greatly rewarding. It teaches you a lot of stuff. One is that I don't loan money. I just don't. Got a lot, but I don't loan it. I give it away. I used to loan money, but I never got any back. All I got was heartburn. And so I just decided, after reading the book a little bit, I don't loan money. I give it away. Literally give it away. I don't give away more than I can afford to lose. If I'm willing to give it away, I genuinely give it, and I have no expectations about getting it back. I just tell them, don't pay me back. I get more back saying, don't pay me back, than I did when I loaned money. You know, so, that's not the method of my madness. My method of my madness is, nobody can con me. I mean, I am con-proof. How do you con somebody if you're playing your own game? I'm going to give away what I want to give away, period. And so I don't get ripped off. It takes two to play that game, and I don't play it. So, anyway, these three steps, I hope that the point's been made about the combat boots. That it isn't about seeking nirvana and staring at my navel and, you know, seeing how blissfully I can get that I'm no use to the world. It's about getting geared up to take on a way of life that is so deeply satisfying, to learn that it's absolutely true that you cannot give away more than you get. I'm the busiest man I have ever known. That's a fact. And I believe that I'm the most fortunate guy on the face of this earth. I am absolutely on fire about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm so old, man, you could almost put me in a lockup. But I am on fire. I'm enthusiastic. I'm as creative as I've ever been. And that doesn't come from sitting around reading lofty books. That comes from being in the action. That's from getting it on. And so the only thing I'd say to you is not only take up on some of those things that I ask you to give real consideration to, but if you're not on fire with this thing, if you're doing hard time in Alcoholics Anonymous, for God's sakes, don't do that. Don't just try to soak this sucker up and think about me, me, me. Turn loose, get into this thing, and man, have a ball.